Our guest is Dr. Jeff Meldrum, a professor at Idaho State University. He focuses on vertebrate locomotion. He's an expert on determining the difference in bone and muscle structure in bipeds, and that's part of why he uses legend and science to understand Sasquatch. We'll get to this scientific exploration of the legend of the Patterson film, the Patterson-Gimlin film, coming up next. It's a big part of this book, and it comes down in a different way than you might expect. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, I was very interested in your book on the Patterson film. I had, in fact, when I first got your book, that was the first thing I did. I went to the table of contents to go look that up, because over the years, we've heard several different versions of how it was a hoax. And even recently, I think perhaps even in the same History Channel special that featured some of the interview with you, I thought they went through some of the bone structure and the way that this monster, or you know, image of a monster turned in the Patterson film. And if it was a Bigfoot, then how would it have acted? If it was a human, how would it have gone? And so I thought, well, I wonder what he's got to say about this. And I was kind of surprised by the findings and the way in which you analyzed it. But we'll just start at the beginning. The Patterson film, for people that don't know, the one from, was it 1971 or two?
67.
I'm sorry, 67.
Yeah,
okay.
45th century this year.
That's right. And Patterson died in like 72 or something like that.
I think so.
Right. And so, in a way, some people said he hoaxed it and didn't tell his partner and took it to his grave. Where are you with all of the discussions of the hoax of the Patterson film?
Well, as you point out, there have been a number of different pretenders rivaling for that apparently coveted slot of being the man in the first suit. But upon examination, each and every one of those claimants' stories doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And, of course, their explanation, their allegations should be scrutinized, I think, just as rigorously as the claims that the film is authentic. You know, the most recent effort was Bob Hieronymus and Philip Morris, the costume maker, who laid claim. Their claims were documented in Greg Long's book. And upon examination, as I said, they just don't hold up. They don't account for the anatomy, for the dynamics, the kinesiology, all the aspects of the film subject as it's walking across that sandbar on that piece of that clip of film. Many of the skeptics, especially those who don't have the acumen to evaluate the film on its own face, take these very circuitous routes to try to debunk by examining the character, examining the context and circumstances. And those are elements that certainly need to be weighed in the balance, but the absence of a reasonable and a conclusive analysis of the film itself is a glaring gap in any argument against the film.
Well, explain what you think is captured on that film, which leads you to conclude that this is more than likely a real image of a Bigfoot walking across a sandbar.
Right. Well, a starting point for me, and probably the starting point for me, was because of my primary emphasis on the footprint evidence and the story, the tale told by that data set. That's where I started. That's where I began, was looking at the associated footprints that were documented on the sandbar, both by Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, at the time of the filming, but then were witnessed by multiple other witnesses, Lyle Laverty of Timber Cruiser, who was on the scene within just a couple of days, snapped off some photographs of some of the clear of the footprints, and some of those same prints were then further cast by Bob Titmus, who came on the scene sometime later. That documentation is really quite extraordinary. Titmus cast 10 successive footprints, irregardless of their quality, and so we have a very good record of the variation from step to step, the variation in toe position, the expression of that mid-tarsal break that I talk about in the book as well, the other characteristics of the foot that might not have been as apparent and discernible if we only had the single right and the left footprint that were cast by Roger Patterson himself. So it's an exceptional case of documentation of a long line of tracks. And then when combined with the film itself, where one can then also evaluate the kinematics, the movements of the film subject, and even details of the movements of the foot, this is clearly not, and anyone who honestly and objectively examines this film has to account for this. The feet that are evident on that film clip are not simple contrivances of carved wooden feet or some simplistic floppy artificial foot of a simple costume. Even some elaborate costumes that I have seen, the feet often come up very short of the mark. These feet show dynamic features and animation that are consistent with a living, articulated, responsive foot, that show points of flexion, that show movement of the toes, that are visible. I mean, that are visible in the film itself. Not referring here to the footprints now,
right,
but then which correlate with the footprints very nicely. And one of the things that really struck me upon looking at the film very closely, focusing on the feet, as there are several frames, series of frames that capture individual step cycles, where you can see as the foot swings forward, the toes dorsiflex or point upward just before the foot makes contact, and then they flex back down against the soil, against the sand, and that is something that you're not going to get with a Ray Wallace style carved wooden foot strapped to the bottom of a costume. The animation is just really amazing.
Right. But, okay, and again, I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit because, I'm the dumbest guy I know. But,
well, for the sake of discussion, that's great.
In your chapter, you got all these super brainy people, right, with all these alphabets after their name,
right,
and none of them can agree on what the size of the image is that's in the film. And every one of them has some sort of way of determining the size of the creature as it walks across the frame of the Patterson footage,
right,
but they vary significantly by some cases like 6 inches from one expert opinion to another expert opinion.
Right.
And it's not just height, but also weight and the sort of the width of the chest,
right.
It kind of goes to show that maybe there is not a hard scientific way of judging whether or not that is accurate. If there could be so many smart people that see it so differently.
Well, there's two issues here. I mean, one is does the analysis of the kinematics of the movements and the gait of the individual, is that dependent on a very precise and accurate estimate of the size and mass? And the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, yes, to the degree that you want to judge aspects like pendulum moments of the extremities, how much inertia is there, are there adaptations of the anatomy that one would expect for a certain weight range or mass as opposed to another. And then on the other hand, there are limitations to the ability to accurately reconstruct the size, and those limitations and the resulting variation due to some of those limitations doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a rigorous scientific approach to try to determine that. I mean, we like you say, the estimates, as varied as they as the few might be, are still within about 6 inches of one another. And I don't think the disparity is so large that we should, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
No, but that made me suspicious. And I'm not trying to be too much of a drag on that, because I would love for the Patterson film to be real. Don't get me wrong. But, sure. I mean 6 inches in terms of a tolerance of science, it's got to be ridiculous. I mean, for a creature that isn't that far away from the film, for something that had some sense of perspective, because, and I'll be more specific, if the creature is determined to be 8'3" tall or something, as like the higher end of the estimates went, that really makes you think, well, gosh, there just aren't that many 8-foot people walking around that could get into a bear suit. But if it's more like 6 foot, you know, okay, well, you know, so I guess I think it is significant to think how tall was the actual creature that's seen in the film, because it would lend credence to one argument over another.
That's true. I mean, in the sense of if it were of excessive height, then you're right, because not only would you have to find the guy that big to fill the costume, but you'd have to make a costume that was very customized to that person. Because you're not going to find a costume off the shelf that's made for an 8-foot person. There's not much of a market for that, is there? So,
no.
So, but I mean, I'm not aware of any estimates, any reasonable estimates that go up into that range.
Right.
So
I'm just saying that that would be my example of why it's important that. But you had, you know, the point you wanted to make. I wanted to hear it.
Well, the range that I'm aware of is, you know, if you take, for example, Grover Krantz's estimate, in which he utilized the foot, the apparent size of the foot as seen in the film. And the only criticism I have of that approach is, I mean, we know the scale of the foot, presumably, by the length of the footprints. And so I think what Grover did was take that foot, look for a frame in which the foot was more or less vertical and therefore more aligned and parallel to the focal plane of the film, and therefore a more accurate projection of its length, and then tried to see how many units of that foot length could be would be necessary to account for the height of the film subject. One of the things that I don't know that he really accounted for, took care for, was the fact that the film was quite overexposed. And those areas that were, or not excessively overexposed, but there was an issue of overexposure, which would make those areas that are light or that are more reflective, like the foot in that perspective, a bit washed out, would burn out on the film a little bit, and thereby blur out the edges of the foot. Now, M.K. Davis, for example, has done some real interesting manipulations of those images, and one of the things that he's shared with me is some of his renderings of the foot. You can actually, with manipulation of the image, demonstrate some of that halo effect or that aura effect of the foot. That could account, especially given the scales that we're dealing with, which in my opinion is the case, that the Grover may have underestimated the height, because he was working with an image of the foot that was sort of artificially enlarged by the overexposure, and therefore he would get fewer of those feet into the height of the subject, which would underestimate the height in his case.
Well, there's something wrong about his criteria to begin with. If he assumed some sort of hard and fast ratio between the size of the foot and the likelihood of the size of the beast that would have a foot that size. And you would have to have, I would think, 100 Bigfoot to measure in order to come up with any kind of hard and fast criteria on foot to body size ratio.
Well, he wasn't working off of any preconception of such a ratio. He simply, if you look at a still frame from the film,
right,
where the foot is in a more or less vertical posture, then and from the tracks we know that that foot is between 14.5 inches and 15 inches. Then if you just take that foot and as he actually did in his book, you just stack foot lengths up the backside of the subject until you reach the crown of the head.
Right.
Then you have an estimate, a rough estimate in this case, of the minimum height, which he estimated a walking height of about 6.5 feet, as I recall.
Right.
Now,
all right.
I think that's
a slight
underestimate because I think the feet he was stacking were a little bit inflated by the overexposure. If you shrank those down or if you allowed for, say, 15 inches instead of 14.5 inches, that would bring you closer to the other more definitive more thoroughly investigated size estimate, which came out just a little over 7 feet. So we're only dealing with, you know, as you said, about 6 inches, but I think that can be reasonably accommodated by the different approaches and the assumptions that are made in each of those approaches.
Well, even though, again, though, if we're talking about 7'2 being the highest, that puts you in a rare category to find somebody who can fit, who would wear a 7'2 costume without it looking fakey, and as opposed to somebody who's 6'6 and much more common. In the end, you conclude that you believe the Patterson film is accurate.
I think based on the knowledge we have at hand, I think it is most likely, most probable that it is, in fact, an accurate representation of a living animal, yes.
All right, and then what, other than the Patterson film, which then would be great, but I mean, in terms of hard evidence, you have, you know, thousands of casts of Bigfoot feet and that sort of thing. What's the best physical evidence that exists for Bigfoot?
Well, I only have in the range of a couple of hundred casts, not thousands, but I would say that does yet still constitute the most compelling case. I mean, now some will quibble that footprints are not hard evidence, it's trace evidence, and that's true. And so if we limit ourselves to just hard evidence, then all we have is hair and potentially some scat samples here and there that in the past, none right in our hands at the moment. The hair, I think, is really interesting, though, and I think that there will potentially be some new light shed on that as we recruit some academics to take a closer look at the hairs that have been collected to date. Dr. Henner Fehrenbach has taken the lead, and much of what I report in the book relies heavily upon his work to try to assemble and make sense of this growing sample, some 15 plus samples now of hair from various independent sources, which all defy identification, defy attribution to a known species, but yet consistently show this core of characteristics that seems to unite all these under a single umbrella. That is interesting. We're working towards getting these independently analyzed and corroborated, and I think that will go, you know, I'm not going to mention it right now who that is just until we get this analysis done, but that will go a long way, I think, in clarifying one way or the other just what it is that we're dealing with here in these otherwise indeterminate hair samples.
Well, as you can tell, Dr. Jeff Meldrum takes his science seriously. He has resisted every attempt I've made to exaggerate for effect. So when I say thousands of foot casts, he's very clear. No, just hundreds. You got to like that in a scientist. He's not willing to, he doesn't want to kite any of these numbers. Sasquatch, legend meets science. And I'll explore some comments made by previous Bigfoot guests coming up next. I'd love to hear Dr. Jeff Meldrum's response to that next. The book is Sasquatch on Coast to Coast AM. It's hard to hear Bad Moon Rising and not think of the film American Werewolf in London, if you've ever seen it. It kind of stays with you in that transformation scene. Yet the director of that movie, John Landis, has just a little corner of this discussion about Sasquatch, legend meets science. We'll start there and then also run back on a couple of other guests we've had on the air on Coast to Coast AM and some of the claims they've made about Bigfoot. I'd like to know where the science of Dr. Jeff Meldrum would fall on those legends next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I bet you didn't know that, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, that John Landis, the director, had sort of an influence on the Patterson film discussion. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
The guy who did Animal House and did American Werewolf in London, and he claimed, he was sort of the mouthpiece for, I guess, the story of that Hollywood special effects guy who, as Hollywood rumor had gone, had said, it was the creator of the costume that was used in the Patterson film.
Right, John Chambers, yes. And all.
That's right, John Chambers. And it was really John Landis that was telling the story about John Chambers.
That's who right, then, I remember that now.
Who later denied it, didn't he? Didn't he deny it to his grave that he had anything to do with it?
That's my understanding. Bobby Short, who has an electronic newsletter, a very good newsletter, had conducted an interview with him in the rest home where he was residing before his passing. And yes, to my understanding of the gist of that interview, he categorically denied it. He said he wished he was responsible. He let others think that he was, and although I don't think he actively perpetuated the rumor, but I mean, all you have to do is just stop and ask yourself, look at the track record of John Chambers, and look at the Planet of the Apes, and if he was capable of pulling off something as was depicted in the Patterson-Gimlin film, why don't we see evidence of that in Planet of the Apes or in anything subsequent to that? Why would someone have those skills and then not exploit them in the film industry?
Planet of the Apes is pretty good, but I take your point. I think I could understand why, if it was bringing him work that people thought he was that good, why rock the boat?
Exactly.
But there have been other guests, and I don't have to go over them by name, but a couple of times I've been halfway through a show on Bigfoot, and then my BS detector is going off left and right, because it seems like some people make it sound so easy to see and or interact with a Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. And there's some people who have claimed sightings into the dozens, or that there are places in the Northwest, well-known places where Bigfoot family groups or community groups can be seen gathering. Do you have any testimony on this that you find credible?
No, I don't. Not that I find credible. I was going to say that that yes, there have been those types of claims, and that you know, the red flag often goes up when someone lays claim to multiple encounters and multiple experiences, you know, that goes beyond the realm of reason and has nothing to corroborate that claim. Nothing to substantiate it, and all we have is their word. There are no pictures, there's no documentation of footprints or any other of the types of corroborating evidence that we look for that aid us in, that let us go beyond just a sole reliance on someone's verbal account.
Is there an area which somebody like yourself, who, again, a professor at Idaho State University, somebody well-respected, somebody doing the hard science of the Sasquatch research, is there an area which is considered to be Bigfoot central?
Well, not really. I mean, I've worked in the past with individuals who have utilized various techniques, including the GIS analysis that we alluded to earlier and so forth, to more systematically point to areas which, quite frankly, you know, you can almost just identify by looking at a map with a scatter of reports and correlating that with just even a cursory knowledge of the types of habitats, the amount of rainfall, the potential for there being the resources that one might expect. I mean, and this is, that in itself is a really interesting angle, because we don't have Bigfoot appearing, at least credibly, in downtown Manhattan or in Central Park or in the Owyhee Desert of Idaho. We have them in areas of Idaho, for example, where there is the appropriate types of habitat and resources. There seems to be an ecological correlation with credible reports that have the types of corroborative evidence we've just mentioned and so on. So no, I don't know of any real hot spots other than those that when you look along the Cascade Range, the Olympic Peninsula, the coastal ranges, these areas where there are still rich habitats in sufficient extent that one might expect there to be the potential for a large animal like this to remain elusive and evasive of human.
Circling back to the beginning of our discussion, where we were talking about the sighting, the Jacobs images, the series of stills that that fired off pretty regularly, that were set up with an infrared camera, and I believe it was a motion detector, wasn't it, that started the shooting?
Most of those do have a passive IR sensor, so that if a warm body moves through the cone of sensitivity, they go off, yes.
Okay. And so if we had an area where they were most likely to exist, it would seem like science would be able to muster enough money to put together, say, 1,000 cameras like that, strategically placed around these areas where, and say, even in the Cascade Mountains, where sightings had occurred before and sightings most likely might occur again, were it not for the fact that Bigfoot would be occasionally, suspicious of human scent, and put these up. I mean, put them up everywhere. Why not?
Well, it sounds easy, doesn't it? But you have not only the initial expenditure in the cameras themselves and the batteries and all the equipment, but then you have to have somebody, or in the case of thousands, if that were the situation, you have to have an entire crew of personnel to monitor and maintain and swap out batteries, swap out film. It is a labor-intensive intensive project. I was talking, we had some great conversations, George Schaller and I, about this possibility. George wrote the foreword to my book and has now openly at least acknowledged the need for serious scientific consideration of this subject. He was using as a case in point one of his graduate students who was studying Asian cheetahs. And this student, a doctoral student, was doing this full time, had many cameras, not in the thousands, but probably in the hundreds. And it was a full time job. And he said, if this student got one picture of on one camera of one cheetah in a given season of field work, they counted themselves really fortunate because this animal was so elusive. And there you're in a much more open habitat, an animal that's more likely to be baitable, bringing them into a camera with a well established protocol for baiting and so forth, and so if you transpose those difficulties over to or challenges over here, I would never encourage a student to undertake a project. Although, George encouraged me that a student could conduct, say, a census of North American wildlife using these types of techniques, Northwestern wildlife, and this would be a reasonable approach. And I think that's true, except that even a wisp of the notion got out that this student was actually interested in capturing a picture of Sasquatch, and that the census was just a front for that objective, I mean, that would really be academic suicide for a beginning student. I think it would be very difficult to establish a career on that.
Why isn't it suicide for you? Why aren't you teaching somewhere at a junior high school by this point?
Well, because I have tenure, and this is one of the reasons for tenure, is that it affords a certain degree of intellectual freedom to pursue risky propositions or risky questions of science. so that even if my colleagues or even if my administrators don't think that this is a worthwhile project, if I'm going about it in a reasonable fashion, then I have some job security. And I think that, you know, through my stick-to-itiveness on this subject and my unwillingness to back down and my efforts to try to apply rigor and objectivity to the question and stay away from, as much as is possible, the sensationalism that this subject often attracts, I've seen some change in attitudes. I mean, the book has been a tremendous tool in that respect. There have been many, many individuals who, once they've picked up the book, there was a great example here on campus, a fellow whose familiarity with the terrain around Idaho was something I wanted to tap into and become better acquainted with, but he was not inclined to to broach this subject, and so I just went ahead on a whim and sent him a copy of the book just gratis and said, you know, hey, if you get a chance, crack the book and take a look. Well, a few weeks later, I got a phone call, and he says, you know, I wasn't even going to look at it. I stuck it on the shelf. And he said, eventually, though, I opened it up, and then I couldn't put it down. And he said, when would you like to get together and talk about this?
Yeah.
I mean, it opened the door for me, an opportunity. And that's been the greatest thing, is it really has helped to elevate the discussion and create new opportunities for collaboration. I mean, people aren't coming out of the woodwork, and some of them aren't even coming out of the closet as far as their interest goes, but they're making contact with me, and behind the scenes, there are lots of academics that are very interested in this subject and really do want to see somebody, at least, go ahead with this type of research.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. The book is Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. How many Sasquatch do you think are living right now in North America? You mentioned it's a small population.
Right. Well, it's really a tough question. I mean, and it really requires going out on a limb and making some serious assumptions. But just to give you a short answer, I think that there are very few. I think that if we're talking about the western United States, western and Pacific, western and Intermountain and Canada, I think that there could be as few as 500. And maybe, you know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 or so. And I know people oftentimes have very decided opinions about what constitutes a viable population. We really don't have a lot of good data on a lot of species on what constitutes a viable population, a healthy gene pool. You know, there are a lot of factors that come into play, life history factors, you know, rates of reproduction and so on, and individual populations have quite varied genetic loads that they're carrying, you know, that would cause inbreeding depression if their numbers were restricted. But if you look at mountain gorillas, there's only about 500 of those in existence on a small mountain range. They have a much denser population in their given range than what we would expect for a Sasquatch with a very different social structure and different habitat regimen. But there's no obvious genetic depression in that population of gorillas, at least none that we're aware of at the moment, and they have a very, very limited number of individuals.
I'll go back to a previous thought just to say, interesting how, though, in the case of the Jacobs video images, that those shots were taken with a motion detector and an infrared camera and were found fairly quickly. You know, so it maybe it's just a reminder that sometimes you can get lucky, and if there is something passing by, you know, it should be, even if it turns out to be some sort of bear with mange, that's a pretty lucky shot to get, even.
Yeah. Well, we've got piles of photographs of all sorts of wildlife and some really great shots of mountain lions and lynx and you know, coyotes, ravens, deer, elk, bear galore. And so you're right. I mean, one would think that this would be the way to go about it. You know, there have been other animals, very rare animals in exotic regions of the world where this type of technique has been successful in documenting unusual and rarely seen animals. But it does take a lot of work. You know, I've talked to some of these people who do this, and you know, they say most people don't have a realistic idea of how much work it takes to run these cameras and maintain them and get those, you know, those $64,000 shots that catch the headlines.
There's a Lincoln researcher that was working with photographs taken at Gettysburg, especially those stereo-optic images that were popular at the time of the Civil War. And I don't know if you saw recently in the newspaper, they found some which, because of his diligence and his belief that if there were so many photographs being taken with those stereo-optic cameras, that there must be one taken of Abraham Lincoln. Hmm. And he just kept looking and looking and looking and blowing up until he found them. He found three, it would appear, of images they never knew had previously existed, and they were already filed. I mean, they already were cataloged. It wasn't like he found them in an attic or something. And I think that's the kind of intriguing part, is maybe the conclusive photo of Bigfoot already exists. We just don't know where it is yet. Let's talk about sound a little bit. And a reminder, too, that we'll get to people's calls coming up next hour. But what's the best audio evidence yet of Bigfoot?
Well, there are a lot of recordings. And let me just preface this by saying that my answers to these varied questions are all qualified in that I'm not expert in all of these subjects. No one person can be. And so I rely heavily on the analyses and the statements of other people. There are lots of recordings that anyone can listen to if they just surf the web. I mean, the one that's the most extensive and that I still find very intriguing are referred to as the Sierra sounds that were taken down in California a number of decades ago, and there are just some interesting qualities to those recordings that still keep me coming back and listening to them and wondering about them. My only concern about that whole episode remains that the associated footprints are of an unusual nature, and they just are. The footprints don't sit comfortably with me as a good, solid corroboration of the experiences that these individuals are having.
If you had to describe the characteristics of the scream, what would the characteristics of a Bigfoot sound be?
Well, there have been a variety of vocalizations described, and that would be expected if this is indeed a large primate. One of the types of vocalizations are these, as you mentioned, screams, these high-pitched sort of wailing cries that can have a tremendous volume and magnitude. These would probably be the types of vocalizations that the animals use when they're advertising their presence, trying to contact a conspecific that's separated by a great deal of distance. If as we suspect, these animals are very dispersed in their environment and rather solitary in their habits. There are also whistling type of a call, which may be a little more proximate, wouldn't carry as far given the reduced volume and magnitude of those vocalizations.
Sure. But
Sierra sounds are quite intriguing because they seem to depict some, you know, what I refer to as proximate vocalizations, where they're individuals interacting with one another.
I'll hang on to that thought. We'll come to that coming up in just a second. And your calls, all the numbers, next. Sasquatch on Coast to Coast AM.